We'll get to questions and comments coming up next hour for M.L. Behrman, Mojave Mysteries, Volume 1. There will be a Volume 2. He does have other books out. They are fiction books. These books and his YouTube channel, you know, he pretty much looks all of these stories squarely in the eye. He doesn't assume that the answer is paranormal. In fact, he kind of calls out many of the stories for having unreliable sources and or information that could be explained away using more scientific methods, which we'll get to. But some of them just don't have explanations. And we'll get to those, too, coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Some very interesting comments I'm reading on Twitter, at Deacon Punnett, and I will share some of those, too, coming up in the last hour. Next hour with M.L. Behrman. We've got more stories to get to, though. These aren't just campfire stories. These aren't just stories which he related that somebody else told him, but rather, as you'll see from his YouTube channel, spends a lot of time in the desert himself trying to get to the bottom of this. And when we left, we were just talking about what you had been learning from the sheriff's or sheriff's deputy, you know. And again, the Mojave is such a big area, and it can mean many different things to different people. But there's certain parts of the Mojave which people would tell you on no uncertain terms should you go out there at night. In some cases, really, ML, the roads aren't even paved. You got to be doing either ATV or a Jeep with appropriate tires, or you could be never heard from again.
Oh yeah, it's definitely non-paved in a lot of it.
Yeah. So you were just talking about the sheriffs, and we're talking about this cult activity, which, you know, some people, they're like, oh, you know, cult stories, it's like a movie, it's like Running with the Devil, it's like whatever. But it doesn't mean it doesn't happen. And it doesn't mean that those pentagrams and the other things that happen, the skulls they find with wax on top and candles and blood, and doesn't mean it doesn't happen just because it also happens in the movie.
Well, right. And that's what I was saying. The story about the Ava Pass gang, this came from 1911. And, you know, before a lot of that was popular culture in our mythology and movies and television. And reading these old articles, you know, they were finding body parts all the time. And in this one case, they wondered if it was this gang that had been known for torturing people using fire by burning off limbs and stuff, or was it what they called dark masses, you know, the worshippers.
The black masses. Yeah, and other, yeah,
yeah. Exactly. Right. And there's such an abundance of articles, you know, going back even farther, the 1860s and on, of, you know, the sheriff or the coroner had to go out and investigate because someone was out in the desert and they found part of a body, or remains. And
right.
There's absolutely no story connected with it. They don't know who it was, what they were doing. You know, is it someone who came to grief by their own actions, or a murder, a robbery, or cult activity? And so it's not a modern phenomenon. This is one cornerstone of my approach, which, if you look at my channel, is I like looking at the historical precedent for a lot of phenomena and encounters and stories to see if, is this something that's been going on for 50 years, 100 years, 200 years,
right,
1,000 years?
Right.
Because that gives you a clue as to the veracity of the account you're hearing, and also a background and an understanding of maybe what could be misconstrued as what's happening also, or how people in earlier times approached it based on their cultural references or development at the time.
And some of those, I mean, we'll just never know. We'll never know, for example, about whether or not at one point there could have been giant, and we use giant roughly, giant spiders, but that there are legit reports of people who say they saw a spider, what, roughly the size of a dog?
Well, the two accounts I got personally, where one was a spider that had an abdomen the size of a football,
right?
That was dragging a rabbit off the road.
Right.
And then when I posted that story, a fellow posted a story about how when he was in the Army, he was driving a truck for supplying the forward bases training out there, and that he saw a tarantula crossing the road from, he said, 3 telephone poles away. That was the distance. He said, even from that distance, I could see how big it was, and I ran over it, and he goes, I was in a huge truck, and when I ran over it, it actually, I felt the tires bounce from this thing. And he goes, you know, I've told people, and they don't believe me, but I saw it, and not only did I see it, I ran over it.
And he didn't get out and collect the carcass. Why?
No. He said he was supposed to be delivering this stuff, and he had right. people in the back, and he wasn't going to stop and, hey, look at this spider I squished.
I'd shovel that thing up. Because you know no one's going to believe you unless you come up. Just take a leg, you know, just bring a leg,
well,
for God's sake.
That's like with any of this stuff. Unless you bring in a body, it all comes down to, do you believe the person or not?
Right. Well, I think that's where, like, you get the story of the demon flyer, which, you know, it's kind of the same sort of thing. We have something which sounds like other legends. It sounds like other stories, but it's very different.
Yeah, and that actually has an interesting postscript to it, too, after that story posted. But just to give people the background on it, I was out in the Mojave Preserve, and I was doing some photography, and I was at a rest stop, or the only rest stop in the preserve, and I was going over my cameras, and a couple who had pulled in next to me turned out to be a husband and wife photographers on assignment, and being camera nerds, we started talking about cameras and stuff like that, and they asked me what I was doing, and I told them about my channel and my book and all that, excuse me, and they gave each other that look that I know immediately, like, okay, something's coming. They saw something.
Right, right.
They want to tell. So after, you know, talking with them a while, they told me this story about how they had been up in the Owlshead Mountains up in Death Valley several months before, and that it was getting near dusk. They were taking pictures of sunsets and just getting background for a story. And the wife said, off to the side, way down to the west, she saw what she thought was just a giant bird glide over these rocks and then drop down out of sight. And we do have condors in California, and they've got huge wingspans, you know. She said, at first she thought it was that, and with the sun where it was, she could really just see a silhouette. And they happened to go by those rocks that she had seen the thing duck over, because that was near their camp. And she said when she got down there, the rocks, she knows, were a lot bigger than she thought they were. So she thought the size of this thing was even bigger than what she originally thought. Now, a condor, I believe their wingspan can get up to 9 feet, 10 feet from tip to tip. And she said it was easily 10, 11 feet. She thought in size when she got down there. So they go to their camp that night. They don't think much of it other than, hey, we saw some big bird just before sundown. And they had a rooftop camper, and they were in their tent, and they had left their cooler by the out near the fire. And she said all of a sudden she was laying there, and she heard something. It sounded like something jumped or, you know, landed on the ground, and she heard rustling in the cooler, or stuff being jostled, and she didn't know what it was, so she tried to wake up her husband because she thought it might be coyotes or something getting into their stuff. And the husband got up, and they listened and thought it was really weird that it sounded more like someone shuffling stuff around. So he got the flashlight, and he quietly opened the tent just enough to be able to point the flashlight out and peer out. And he, you know, she was right next to him. And they said that when they put the flashlight out near the fire, they saw a figure crouch down, just a silhouette. And then when the light hit it, it whipped around, and she said this face was all dark, and it looked she said the damnedest thing is that it looked like a woman sneering, or, you know, real, real angry with bright red eyes. And he said the next thing is this thing stood up, and they guesstimated it was maybe 5 feet tall, stood up, and all of a sudden unfurled these two giant wings and leapt straight up into the air and took two big flaps to get up in the air. And they looked out, and it circled over the campsite a couple times and then took off. And excuse me, they said that, you know, they just kind of looked at each other like, oh my God, what was that? And
right.
Did you see what I just saw? And they both described it to each other, you know, and they pretty much saw the same thing. And so that was it. And then they said it never came back, and it looked like it had been trying to get in the cooler, or at least moving the food supplies out there around, or with the containers. And the gravel was too hard. They said you really couldn't see any tracks or anything where this thing had been crouching. And that was it. So,
it brings us back to the story of the people of the campsite you found with the coolers and nobody around. It's like,
yeah, and the dog.
And the dog. Tie those two stories together.
Right. But so, when I started researching it, I got an email from a gentleman, because I put out an email to people I knew if they had heard anything like that. And I got one from an elderly gentleman who lived up in that same area, who said that when he was young, his grandmother, who was part Native American, would tell him a story of a creature they called the demon flyer, and that it liked to come out on hot nights, certain times of the year, and that you could see it, and that you should never be out alone if the demon flyer was out.
I think that's good advice.
Yeah.
I'll take that advice anywhere. I don't have to be in the Mojave.
That he had once seen it, too, by the side of the road, picking at roadkill or something. And he thought it was, he said it, he also thought it was female. He actually described it had breasts. Those were two reports that I got. So I did the story on that, right?
Right.
And I really couldn't find out much more eyewitness stuff. And I did find in the archives stories of giant birds and possible people that thought they had seen, you know, flying reptiles and stuff like that over the years out there. But then when I posted the story, I got a slew of comments from people who described basically the same thing, although some said it was male, some said it was 3 feet tall, 4 feet tall. And I got real interesting thing from two people who described seeing the same thing on the same stretch of road, but 5 years apart, who didn't know each other. They didn't know the existence of each other. And when I told each one about the other, they were like, you know, I only told a few people over the years because everyone thinks you're crazy. And, you know, to hear that someone else saw it on that road is amazing. Then I got an email from a biologist, wildlife guy, who said he's researching what he thinks might be an undiscovered species of giant hunting owl. Now, we've got owls of all sizes in the Mojave, everything from little burrowing owls that live in the ground to great big hunting owls that stand maybe a foot and a half, 2 feet tall, that are quite large. I mean, they're big.
Yeah, really. Yeah, they're fierce.
Owls. But he said this thing that he thinks is an undiscovered species, he thinks could easily be 2.5-3 feet tall. And with that type of bulk, he said it could easily be misconstrued for
a person.
Some of these people might be seeing.
Especially because owls would have their eyes facing forward. And so it would look a little more like a flatter-faced person.
Right, and with the peaked ears,
or
at least the hair that peaks up, it can look like horns because they have horned owls.
And in the dark and in a moment of fear where people may not be processing information very quickly anyway, it could be all of those things.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So that was an example of his story that I got firsthand from people I'd met, and then got other people commenting that they had seen the same thing, and then I actually got a answer that might come from the other side of the fence, where it, you know, no, this is a terrestrial animal. It's just
right, just one that hasn't been typed yet. Yeah,
right, exactly.
We're talking about Mojave Mysteries. ML Behrman, we'll get to your questions coming up next hour, but one of those stories you can't. I mean, it's not much of a story, but it makes a great piece on your YouTube series, and I highly encourage people to subscribe, because you should have a lot more viewers of these. These are really well done stories, 5 or 6 minute segments. You'll see versions of many of the things that we've been talking about tonight, and these deserve to go viral. These deserve to be everywhere. I mean, have selfie stick will travel. You do a nice job with the. For your one man banding it, and your audio is great. It's really good. So, yeah. So, but this is the interesting, was that whole thing about the iron door, and this too could have a very terrestrial explanation. But we've got like 2 minutes here. Try explain if you can just a little bit about this mysterious iron door in the middle of the desert.
Right. Well, this is it's in what has now become Joshua Tree National Park. And it's very near the property of a character who originally homesteaded that part of the park from like 1920 to the 1960s, a fellow named Bill Keyes. And he was a miner, and he also ran a stamping mill, which is, you know, where the big hammers will smash the ore into powder that they can then try and separate the gold out of. And he used to do his own milling, and he'd also do milling for people that ran mines in the area. And near his property, later on, people found this little cave. And it's very little. You got to crouch down to go into it. It's a natural formation in the rocks that has a metal door, an iron door to it that locks from the outside.
And that's the key part, from the outside. So we know somebody hadn't made a little habitation for themselves out in the desert.
Right, exactly. And it's in a crook of these rocks you got to crawl up on. So now, in mining, people keep their dynamite and explosives away from the habitated part. And they'll usually have a dynamite hut or a little cave where they store stuff. So it's not unusual to find something like that on a mine, but there's no mines around this, and where it's located, you would have to crawl around to get in and out of it, and doing that with a bottle of nitroglycerin or dynamite or anything seems kind of troublesome when you could construct something on the flat.
But, I mean, the key part, there's no mines around, so why would you ever need a place to store dynamite or nitroglycerin if there are no mines around?
Right. Exactly. Now, either there's a hidden mine that people don't know about, or now here's one story, and I don't want to smear Bill Keyes or his descendants, is some people accused him of pilfering some of the gold from other people's stampings that would bring him, you know, stuff to run his mine. And one theory was that that's where he was hiding the stolen gold, was in this little iron door cave, away from his property, you know, out in the middle of nowhere, that, you know, so people wouldn't find it. So there's a criminal explanation for it. Now, there's also a third folklore story that I heard from some of the locals, that there was a local family that lived there that had a deformed child who... And, you know, this is in the parlance of the times, was demented. And the mother didn't want the child in the house, so the father built this thing out in the rocks to basically keep him like a prisoner and would bring him food and stuff like that. And that...
That explains the lock on the outside of the door.
Yeah, and if you go in it, and you can see in my video, I was in it, I shot all that stuff. There's like one little hole that could either be construed as an air hole or a hole that you shove
something
in, because the door doesn't have a hatch for that type stuff.
I want you to hang on to that thought for a second, because while I was reading that part, I was also wondering whether there are ever doors that are found that lead to the underground cities that are rumored to be in the Mojave. I'll talk about it in a second. Mojave Mysteries, ML Behrman next on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. Well, it's so nice to be back, and thank you for all the kind words on Twitter, Facebook, etc. At Deacon Punnett is my Twitter handle, and I'm enjoying hearing some of the comments. I like Mama Sun Ross said last hour that this whole idea about the flying demons reminded her of the flying monkeys from the Wizard of Oz, and others have suggested that maybe the story about the devil worshippers in the desert sounded like Manos, the hands of time. And I think that's what happens with these stories. They sound like something else. And yet, at the same time, if you've ever spent any time driving around the desert, you can't help but think of some of the only way you can relate to it sometimes is by making this association with movies. For example, I was driving up to Vegas just a couple of months ago. I have this annual convention I go to, and I try to always see George Knapp, by the way, whenever I go up there. We missed each other by hours last time. He was just coming into town just as I was leaving. And it's always cool, I mean, in the time that you have, but when you're driving through the desert at night, you look at, and I marvel, you could, on 20 yards off the road in either direction, you could be digging a grave and no one would be able to see it from the highway. You could be doing it out in the open and no one would be able, it's so dark. There are just, there's no ambient light except for the lights of the occasional, headlights that are coming your way. And even that doesn't count. And you have to stay, really, your head has to stay on a swivel as you're driving through the desert because of coyotes and other creatures that run across the road. And that's just the kind of terrestrial stuff we know about. So what about the giant men, the foiled men, the cement men? What about the other hominids that might be out there? Sounds crazy. Pick your movie you want to make it relate to, but we'll have ML Behrman wrap up the last story and address some of these others before we get to your calls coming up next hour. Mojave Mysteries on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Of course, I got my PhD from Arizona State University. While I was still working on my dissertation, I taught an online class, just like the ones you were talking about in the last commercial. I had 200 students in an online class, and I would say half of them worked at Starbucks because Starbucks was paying for college courses for their baristas. So everybody who was writing papers would often write about their experiences vis-a-vis Starbucks. It was very interesting. And I learned a lot. It was a fun class. It was about pop culture in the media. So we're talking about Mojave Mysteries, ML Behrman. And then next week, we'll talk a little bit more about this from a different angle. I have 2 weeks I'll be on. And I don't know, that I'm just sort of fascinated with part one and part two on this, about the murders that happen. And these are ones that are actually being tracked, or the missing people that are still being searched for. Or in many cases, people, if it's not a family member that's still putting up posters, no one will ever hear about these people again. And it happens around the Highway 29 Palms, which I'm sure, ML, you know that highway well.
Oh, yes.
Do you know Deanne Stillman? Does that name mean anything to you?
No.
You might really enjoy talking to her. She would be a kindred spirit for you. And she's written a couple of books about tourism in the desert, and she too, sort of a desert maven, she's been writing about some of the murders that happen around the Mojave, and particularly as it connects to that road. And I'm sure you've heard some of the stories there too of the number of predators that may be at work looking for women who are driving across the desert at night, even on the more populated roads, not even forget the smaller roads, and the cars that they find later on with nobody in them, and right, then never hear from those people again. It's really a tragedy, and there's not a whole lot police can do. I mean, it's just such a wide area, you can't forensically search the Mojave Desert, so all you could do is usually just hope for some kind of tip. But in this case, we were talking about this door, this iron door, and you can see this in ML Behrman's YouTube channel. Really, you should subscribe. It's great. All of these Mojave mysteries are covered in there, and you can see the mystery of the iron door. And you were just saying it was on the property of a homesteader, so a guy who was making a claim for that property who then abandons the claim. It's now part of the Joshua Tree National Forest?
Well, the Park Service bought out a lot of claims in that area, but his homestead actually still stands as a tourist attraction. They do.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah, because he built this fabulous little ranch, and he was a real character, interesting character. But this was a rumored dark side that he might have had, or, you know, back then a lot of the people that were mining were also accused of being, you know, horse thieves or claim jumpers or outlaws. So, like I say, the Iron Door Cave has those three theories behind it. A, it was just a simple blast chamber where they were keeping explosives for a mine that hasn't been found yet, or it was where he was keeping rumored alleged pilfered gold, or that some other family built it, and it was this cell, holding cell for this poor developmentally challenged.
Yeah. Which is a little bit like the New Jersey Devil story, right? It's a little bit like the legend of the Jersey Devil.
Yeah, I've heard variations of it, and I actually use this as the genesis for one of my Western horror novels, The Charred Man, because it was about, you know, a child who had been burned severely and was, you know, they considered him a monster. And after he was burned, they even considered him more of so. And he became the sidekick to his outlaw dad and did horrible things across the West until our hero stopped him. So, you know, three choices, take your pick.
Yeah.
You know? What's behind the door? Take your choice.
Yeah, but you go see it. You can find it by going to the YouTube channel for ML Behrman. So, but that, you know, it's sort of like take your pick on a lot of stuff when it comes to the desert. So, you know, let me ask you what the research says. What are the very earliest known? How far back are the earliest inhabitants of the Mojave?
Well, they believe the Native American cultures out here go back almost 8,000 years. The Paiute tribe, the Coso tribe, their variations, they believe from the rock art that, like I said, that they could go back between 6,000 and 8,000 years. And a lot of these tribes have mythologies and stories like any Native tribe does. And some of them touch on themes that seem to carry through right up through historical times to our time. And that's one of the things that fascinates me. And you had mentioned the underground cities.
Yeah.
Now, up in Death Valley, the Paiute tribe has a tradition, as I understand it, that at one time there were giants that lived there, and through conflicts with the tribe, were driven underground or lived underground or came from underground. It depends on which variation you adhere to. And that they were, you know, all the hallmarks of your classic giant race, weird technologies, all sorts of strange animals and stuff and dress, and that they were physically huge, you know, 8 to 12 feet tall, which I'll just put that out there. That's what the story says.
And now, there's drawings and stuff that of them. I mean, it's not like just an oral tradition.
You know, you've got to be very careful with some of the alleged drawings and stuff because you don't know exactly what's being portrayed. There are etchings and stuff where they'll show one character will be very large and they'll be surrounded by smaller ones, and you don't know exactly what they're denoting there. You know, is it just a great man in the tribe surrounded by lesser ones, or is this an actual other being that's physically bigger or whatever. And a lot of it's been spun online, especially with stories of, you know, massive bodies being found and spirited off to the Smithsonian and hidden and stuff like that. So,
but are there any giant mummies? Have they not found any unusually large corpses? Because that, you're right. I've heard this story. In fact, I think we...
Well, there was the one story, I believe the... I'm trying to think of the cave. Not Skylock. There's a cave where allegedly these giant red-haired mummies were found.
Right.
And no, there has not been any bodies produced. There's been artifacts produced that come from a prehistoric culture of like duck decoys, hunting decoys, and stuff like that. But not, I've not seen any credible giant pictures or reports of giant bodies. Now, one thing I covered in my thing that I found, let's fast forward to 1948. There was a series of articles that came out that the a self-described scientist and his assistant were up in Death Valley, and they were exploring an area, and they fell through a section of the desert floor into a giant cavern and found that it was a series of interconnecting tunnels and rooms, and when they followed it, they found all the classic elements of the old Peyote story. You know, they found giant mummified bodies, they found armor, they found treasure rooms, they found skins from animals that had been extinct since just at the end of the last ice age, strange writing, all this stuff. Now, that's what they said in their report when they got back to Los Angeles, and they actually gave a series of lectures, and of course all the scientists of the time poo-pooed it because they're like, wait, this is one, you didn't bring us any artifacts, you didn't take any pictures, and you're mixing up all sorts of historical things. You know, you've got supposed hieroglyphic writing, and then you've got animals that went extinct in the ice age, and then you've got armor and giant bodies, and it was a real flap for a couple years. And I know anyone out there who knows the story, it will probably want to come back and say, yes, but there's been this book by this guy and this book by that guy. And yeah, there's been a huge cottage industry on the story. But as of yet, I have not seen any real scientific stuff, although I just received pictures from an individual who said that they had found an entrance to something like that. But, you know, it's a huge story out of Death Valley about this underground city, and supposedly there's an underground river, and then, you know, I've heard guys that are into treasure hunting and stuff like that. It's been stories about how it connects to with there's a giant underground golden river of ore.
Right.
It's also there, and
that's where it starts to go really over the top. Like,
I got to the point where I was like, you know, it just needs the Abomo Snowman and Loch Ness Monster to show up.
Right.
And we'll have the entire cast.
But the intriguing part of that is that there could be, and it could easily be lost, but there could be naturally forming underground caverns, because again, if you found something, you might be the only person who found it, and before you could go back, find your way back to civilization, you may never be heard from again either in the Mojave. So, I mean, it's not like a lot of road signs. There's not like a lot. I mean, it'd be easy enough to find something and just as easy to lose it too, I guess.
Well, yeah, that's how the whole lost treasure industry works out here. So many of those stories, the guy finds something and then it rains. And he can't find his way back, or it's a different time of day and the shadows are different. And it is very true. I mean, you can go out in the morning and head one direction, and then at night you're coming back and the lights change and things will look different. I could readily see. And there's no shortage of caves, caverns, and underground things in the
and abandoned mines, which...
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Again, so those would be the man-made type. And so, you know, again, this sort of, let me dovetail into something because we're going to be taking questions at the top of the hour. And I think this is where we say very likely we'll have to have you back at some time in the future. Maybe, I don't know when I'll be back on after next, I'll do next Sunday. And then I don't know when I'll be back on again, but George Norrie would be great with this topic too, because this whole thing about all these different hominids, you know, we mentioned the flying demon woman, the face that could be an owl, but it freaked out a lot of people. What about, you know, some of these things like you have very credible man-dog stories, you know, or what some people call werewolf, and then you've got these other hominids that could be, I mean, you make a point to try not to use the B word, right?
Right, right.
Yeah, because you don't want to say Bigfoot, because everybody, a lot of people could roll their eyes, but there are people who said they've seen something that seemed like it was surviving quite well out in the desert all by itself.
Well, yeah, and again, there's a long history with the native tribes of seeing creatures like that, which they term the elder brother, or different names, and they treated it everything from just another creature that lives out there that doesn't bother them, so they don't bother it, to a spiritual being that lives between two worlds, you know, and goes back and forth and only appears when it's going to deliver a message or something.
Right.
Then I have just a ton of reports from the 1800s of, you know, when the cowboys and stuff were in here, and that's what actually spurred me to write my first Western horror novel. But they used to call them wild men. Or the favorite term of the time was the what is it, which I always love because it's so classic.
Right.
And then nowadays we have the cement monster, the yucca man, the sandman. And a lot of
but
people
even the
believe
foil men were so, the tin, right? I mean, that was like a whole other thing, but it sort of falls into the same category.
Right, right. Well, I have a subcategory that I kind of keep to myself, which is called I Saw It on the Road. Because right. So many of these stories are from people traveling on the road, and they see something cross in front of them or standing by the side of the road or whatever. And for 90% of the people that visit the desert, that's their experience of it, is driving long stretches of empty road through desolate areas.
Right.
And, you know, so when they see something, it's almost always on the road. Whereas if you're out in the backcountry, it's a different type thing. A lot of people think that these things, if they exist, actually exist up in the mountain ranges, and they're crossing the open desert to get to another mountain range or a water source when you
right.
see them in the desert proper or on the
and hunt. It would make sense for them to travel at night if they
I'll tell you a real quick story. My personal thing, I actually found tracks. Now, I always thought, you know, when I was first out here, when I'd hear stories like this, it'd be like, yeah, right, the Bigfoot in the desert, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, me and my buddies like to just sometimes just take a satellite photo, find a real remote area, and like, yeah, let's see if we can get the Jeeps into there and camp and do some exploring and come out. So I had found this one area was a narrow canyon near an area that we had explored before, and I thought, yeah, we can probably get through that. So one day we took three vehicles in, and the canyon got narrower and narrower and narrower and finally pinched out, and we had to turn around. I got out of my Jeep and was directing people to turn around because it was so narrow you had to really spot. And there was a small sandy wash at the bottom, and I looked down, and right next to where I was standing was this giant footprint. And when I say big, I mean big. Like, I'm a big guy, size 13 feet. I'm 6'2", 250 pounds. So this thing was dwarfed my boot, and it was fresh. I mean fresh. Like, you can tell tracks in the desert, the wind blows and it smooths them out real quick. Well, this was fresh, and I got down on my hands and knees and lifted this thing. I could actually see where the heel had struck, the ball of the foot dug in, and then the toes pushed off. And you could still see the sand ridged up between the toes where it pushed off. So I immediately started looking for another one. I found another one that had been run over by one of the Jeeps. And it was
you're going to need to hang on to that right there. That's just where we'll pick it up. We'll also run the numbers after the top of the hour so you can join in the conversation, too, with ML Bearman. I'm glad to see he's not quite at 1,000 on YouTube subscribers, but he should be. Great videos. You can link up to him at coasttocoastam.com. This is Ian Punnett.